Hi, and welcome to Gen Extemporaneous. This is a podcast where I come up with an idea, I do some research, I grab a bottle of Rombauer's Chardonnay, I bring everything to Mark, and he pontificates. Today's episode is a free sample of our Patreon content. This is an extended conversation based on episode number 87, Life Lessons and Stereotypes in the Breakfast Club. Mark and I talk about behind-the-scenes shenanigans, people who tried out and failed to get a part in the movie, and what John Hughes imagined would be the ultimate outcome for each of the main characters. Thank you for coming and listening to us each week. And if you do like our content, please consider sharing us with a friend. Hi, Mark Snedeker.
Hello, Christina LaRusso. So, Rombauer, that's the last free plug you get.
After
Start
this,
writing checks.
We need at least a case of wine.
And checks.
And checks. All right, that's a little bit of a joke. We are having some drama in the Willverse, everyone. It's just constant.
And that is very surprising.
No, well,
normally
I know,
it's
right?
It's such a placid area of the internet.
Oh, it's gotten little crazy.
You would think when the main character exited the stage that things would calm down. But of course, we knew they wouldn't.
They did not. And they've just gotten wilder and weirder. And there's just the thing that's interesting to me is that the press is still at the gates.
Oh, are they?
Yes, they are. So it's interesting to watch how this is all going to unfold. At some point, there is going to come along someone who says this is worthy of some extended study, and they will put it to film. I'm telling you.
Yeah.
All right. So let's talk about what we are doing today. We are offering a free sample of Patreon content that has been up for a couple of weeks on our Patreon. I think we have now 12 or 13 episodes that people could binge.
My God.
I know.
You know we have jobs, right?
Yes, I know we do. This content is all free that we do here on Gen Extemporaneous. We have no sponsors and we have no ads. We run ad free on this. So we do have a Patreon. If you are interested in supporting us, we would appreciate it. If you can't, that's fine too. We just enjoy putting out this content. I don't know. We do maybe three different styles of content on Patreon.
Internet archaeology, where we randomly select a date in the past and then we research it to try to give you a little picture of what life was like on that day, at that time, in that era, etc. Give it some context. We also do Video Thunderdome, where we pit four videos against each other and judge them based on, obviously, quality and content, but also on a number of 80s tropes that we like to see in our videos.
Correct. And then finally, we do what we're going to share with you today, which is an extended conversation based on episodes that while we were in the episode, there was maybe a thread that we introduced but couldn't fully pull on that thread.
You love pulling threads.
I love it.
You're like a seamstress.
I am. And
that makes a lot of mistakes.
That's what we're doing today. We had a fantastic conversation with one of our guests, Andrea.
She was a value add.
I agree.
I think we should circle back, you know, stick a pin in it.
Are you mocking me?
Yes.
And my word choices now?
No, I'm mocking business speech everywhere.
Oh, okay. So Mark and I decided there were actually a lot of different things that we wanted to talk about. We couldn't fit into that episode. It was already a long episode and we couldn't fit it in. So here is an extended conversation that Mark and I had about things like who some of the actors were that read for the parts.
And if this goes really well, then we're going to dive even deeper and like talk about the craft services they had available. Maybe, you know, the biography of the key grip.
No, that is not what we're going to do. This is where it ends. Well, thanks everyone for coming to listen to us. We do appreciate it. Our Patreon address is
www.patreon.com/GenExtemporaneous.
All right.
On with the show.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to Gen Extemporaneous.
After Dark.
I'm Mark Snedeker.
Hello, Christina LaRusso.
Hi, everyone.
Aw, yeah.
Welcome to Gen Extemporaneous After Dark. Well, you know what? I'd like to start out this Patreon by saying thank you so much to all of those of you who have joined our Patreon.
My God.
We have been really
inundated.
Surprised at the great response that we've received. So thank you so much. We had a great conversation with Andrea, who was our special guest for our Breakfast Club regular episode. We spoke with Andrea for 3 hours.
That was a lot of Breakfast Club stuff. I
cut a lot out. I mean, I got us down to like, I think, an hour and a half.
Yeah. Still pretty long episode.
It was a very long episode. So, but there are some things that I think we didn't get a chance to really talk about, and that's kind of some of the fun stuff.
Right on. Let's do the fun stuff.
The, you know, like maybe a little bit of the trivia. So for this episode, one of the things that I did for research was to read a book called You Couldn't Ignore Me If You Tried, The Brat Pack, John Hughes, and Their Impact on a Generation by Susanna Gora.
What was the best thing in that book?
It just kind of gives you the behind the scenes. Like, right. So they go kind of into detail about how John Hughes sort of said, well, I have this script. I'd like to also direct this.
Right. And they're like, and you've directed how many movies before, sir? Oh, none.
Uh-huh. And so this would be his directorial debut. And so what ended up happening is they liked the movie. They liked the script. They wanted to have the movie filmed. But then they decided they wanted him to do a different one before that. And he had happened to be writing a script for it. And so he finished a script, this other script, which ended up being 16 Candles.
That's Hollywood logic right there, right?
It's weird.
That makes no sense to me. Like, we're not sure if you're ready to direct a movie, so we're going to need you to direct a movie to show us that you can direct this movie.
Well, okay, but see, the John Hughes thought that because the Breakfast Club largely takes place in one room.
Yeah, that's easier.
He thought that would be much easier to direct.
He's right.
Then, as it turns out, it's much more, when it's like that, it's much more character, you know, it's story driven. Sure. And that might not be, if he's not a great director, they don't know if he can get those performances out of those actors.
I think that it's a mistake to ever assume that those Yahoos are really that logical.
You have such disdain for just about every class of worker in the world.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
My God. So that's the kind of stuff that was coming out of this book.
Did she tell you about the fact that basically Judd Nelson decided at the ripe old age of 24 that he was going to be a method actor and continue to bully Molly Ringwald throughout the shooting?
No, I didn't hear. Did he do that to her?
Yeah, and really? He almost got fired.
Really? Yeah. Oh my God. I did hear that John Hughes really had this strong connection with these teenagers.
Yeah.
When he worked with Molly Ringwald and Anthony Michael Hall in 16 Candles, he realized that they would be cast.
Oh, in, of course, yeah. Breakfast, they had the inside
Club.
Track.
They definitely did. He really bonded with those two in particular, and both of them have kind of copped to that they were his muse in many ways. And he went on to work with Molly Ringwald again, with Anthony Michael Hall again. But anyway, he had this very close relationship with them. And one of the things that he did with the direction of The Breakfast Club was to kind of, well, I don't know if he insisted, but he held rehearsal, which is not usual for films.
Yeah.
It's normal for plays, but not for movies. So he, for 3 weeks, they had a really long extended rehearsal period.
Interesting.
And he felt, then they would come in and they would read the script from front to back and just go through it chronologically. And then in the end, it was also filmed chronologically. Yeah.
So do you know who was almost Bender?
Nicolas Cage.
Nope.
But then also John Cusack.
That's right. Yeah. He was actually, he'd come out several times to audition.
Yeah.
That would have changed the movie significantly, I think. But I'm sure he would have done fine.
He would have done. I think he would have.
He's not as menacing, I don't think.
As menacing, right. And I actually was, you know, because John's retweeted me.
Yes, he has. So you guys are tight.
So I was.
You have a close, personal, parasocial relationship.
But I almost did. I thought, at John Cusack, if you had had the chance to play Bender, would you have done anything different? I mean, let's talk that through.
I mean, he would have been able to achieve sullenness, right? That's not a problem.
Now, remember, this isn't John Cusack. Lloyd Dobler, John Cusack. This is John Cusack.
No, even
Cusack
before. This is
way
like real,
before.
Like Weird Science.
No, remember. No,
what was the one?
He was in 16 Candles.
Yeah.
Remember John Cusack in 16 Candles?
Yeah, he was
Candles.
A baby.
He was a
First First of all, he was way too baby-faced.
Yeah.
You had to pick, I mean, that there's a reason why Judd Nelson was the oldest actor picked.
Right.
Because you have to have that kind of, oh my God, is he shaving already?
Yeah.
You know, you have to have that kind of sense about high school bad boys.
Yeah, they needed someone a little bit older. He wasn't there yet. I think later on he could have, but Judd Nelson did such a fantastic job.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, at this point, it's silly to even talk about recasting any of those spots just because they're so iconic at this point. You just can't picture anybody else really doing it.
Mm-mm. There's a couple of different stories that are out there about Claire's part. So as I mentioned, Molly Ringwald, she was told by John Hughes during 16 Candles, you're going to be in Breakfast Club. The word is that he didn't tell which female part. Uh-huh. And Molly, reading it, thought she wanted to be Allison.
Right, she wanted to be the basket case.
But in his mind, he was courting Ally Sheedy for that role.
Yeah.
Okay, so...
let's not use that word.
Well, you know what I mean. No, he was coming after her, trying to get her interested in doing that role.
Recruiting her.
Well, okay, I say court, you say recruit.
I do.
Then Molly kept wanting to be Allison, and she kind of fought it for a while, and then he went to her and had a heart-to-heart with her. That's one story. Then the other story is that Molly didn't really care. Molly is actually on record saying, I really don't remember wanting to be Allison. I wanted to be Claire. And then she said something like, I had just come out of playing kind of an outcast character as Samantha Baker.
Okay, yeah.
So she said it wouldn't really stretch me as an actress.
Yeah.
But, I mean...
And we talked about how great she was.
She was so good.
Even though she doesn't have that kind of cookie cutter, cheerleader, you know, look.
Yeah.
She pulled it off. I mean, she pulled it off.
Oh, well, she was glamour. You know, the thing is that you don't always have to be like, you know, it helps, I guess, if you have that. But really, I think that a lot of people, it's to do with charisma, too.
Yeah. You know, and she was, and just watch her during that film, and she's very self-possessed during the whole thing, and her movements are very economical, like when she's unpacking her lunch, mm-hmm. you know, and everything is very, you know, kind of neat and organized, and she's confident, but she does, she just has that air, she cultivated that air of princessness.
Uh-huh.
So, who played Carl?
John Kapalos.
Right. There's a story that during the shooting, you know, trying to make all the younger actors feel more comfortable, he was telling them, you know, don't be super too intense, you know, you got to chill a little bit. And he told a story about how Martin Sheen suffered a heart attack during Apocalypse Now. And Emilio Estevez got really pissed. And John Kapalos had no idea that Martin Sheen was Emilio Estevez's dad.
Oh, my God.
And he's talking about, you don't want to be like Martin Sheen. He goddamn near killed himself on Apocalypse Now.
Oh, my God.
And Emilio is like, it's going to be two hits, man. Me hitting you, you hitting the floor.
Oh, my God. I didn't know that.
Is that a great story?
That's a good story. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
That's terrific.
So he's just trying to make him feel better. And I picture him doing that as Carl with, you know, his, like, gloves on.
Yeah.
He's, like, holding his finger up, you know, in that kind of, you know, Greek chorus sort of way.
Yeah.
And he's like, you know,
oh my God,
it's my dad, man.
That's my dad. That's why. Well, oh, speaking of Carl, though, do you know who played him? Was hired and shot some scenes?
Bill Murray?
No.
Oh, I would guess.
Rick
Moranis?
Rick Moranis.
Hey, how's it going, Breakfast Club? Even though you do your own homework, which you really shouldn't do.
He was going to do it with a Russian accent and play it
really
for laughs.
Yeah.
And with like big keychain.
Oh, that would have been not great.
It would
have been way too distracting from the kids.
Right.
And he's there and he's like, oh, yeah, you guys, you know, these janitors that you spit on, they're quite aware of what they're going through.
Mm-hmm.
And he did a very, very good job. Yeah, that would have been a really weird... I mean, we wouldn't know, right?
But then they fired him.
For being too Russian?
Because he wouldn't... They said, the director said, this is not how I want this role to be played.
He's like, hey, and man, I was in Ghostbusters. Don't you guys know what's up?
God. And so then he said, and that's it. I'm not gonna... He said, if I can't play it the way I want to play it, and then they said, okay, well then...
He's like, do you know who I am? I'm Canadian, bro.
Yeah. And then he's like, well, okay, bye.
All right, I'm off to the great white north, eh?
And then they brought in John Kapalos, and he said that he had actually... been promised that role.
Yeah.
And then the studio kind of said, well, we need a bigger name. And then I don't know why they would have done that. To me, that's a
bigger
studio
name to play a very small part.
Right. Which would have then shifted the...
Why don't they bring in just Jack Nicholson. Yeah. Jack Nicholas, the golfer. Hi, I'm the Golden Bear. I'm your janitor. What's up? You guys want to go out and play 18? I mean,
you referenced just before a song lyric. Would you recite the song lyric?
Bowie.
And what song?
These children that you spit on, they're quite aware of what they're going through. Change, turn and face the strange changes. Might have got those lyrics wrong.
Oh, wow. Might delete later. Talk to me about that lyric.
Well, I mean, I think, and I haven't done any extensive studies on this. In fact, I've done no studies on this whatsoever,
right. This
as
totally
per usual.
Totally
so I think what he's talking about is the youths, right, are overlooked by the generation kind of in control, mm-hmm. right? Like these children that you spit on, I mean, it's not like they're just automatons or they're just, you know, stereotypical placeholders. They're humans, mm-hmm. right? And they're quite aware of what they're going through, mm-hmm. right? And you might not be.
Mm-hmm.
So shut up, adult people.
But the only reason that class of human teenager even exists is because adults have made it so that they can exist.
You mean by giving birth to them?
No.
I mean, surely that is true.
No, but we are living in an era where the concept of the teenager is a relatively new concept. There wasn't between, you know, adolescence and adulthood. Right. By the time you were very young, you were working in
it's not like adults created that segment, that market segment, because out of the goodness of their heart, they realized they could make money off of them, right? They could sell them rock and roll music. They can sell them, stuff in the mall. They can sell them MTV. You know, they can sell them things. And that's, I think, when they started getting culture directed towards them, because they were a market, right? So they started getting culture directed towards them, movies, music, clothing.
But that market had been created by the baby boom the post-war, economic.
Right. That's what I'm saying. Because they realized they could sell them shit.
Sure. I know. Yes. Yes. If the adults weren't doing what the adults were doing to make teenage years possible.
Right. They could just ignore them like they always used to.
They
wouldn't. Or make them young adults and put them to work.
That's what I mean. You just become an adult younger. You know, responsibilities.
Yeah, it wasn't a conscious decision to say, you know what, we really should pay attention to those teens, right? It was a result of the economics of the time where, guess what? Teens no longer had to go and work at mill, mm-hmm. right? They didn't have to go to the mine. They can, you know, they have all this spare time and there's disposable income, etc., and that kind of created that class of human.
So do we not know what we do? Of course we know what they're going through, because we've been through what they're going through. I'm just trying to think, the assumption there is that they're quite aware of what they're going through. Meaning what to you?
That they're not just, you know, blissfully unaware of their circumstances, and they, you know, they have real problems, real issues, and they have awareness of the world.
But do you think it could be that they are thinking that they are well aware of what they're going through? Does that mean that they are saying, shut up, stop trying to dictate to them what they're going through?
Right. Don't tell them. Don't try to tell them, you know, like Roger Mudd or Walter Cronkite, right? Don't tell them what they're going through. They know. They're the experts on them.
So what's interesting about that to me is that in the beginning, Brian says, you know, we're here in his little speech before the movie, and he says at the end, we were brainwashed. We thought we knew who we were when we walked in, but we were brainwashed.
Right.
And so that means that, like, their understanding of who they are and who they're meant to be is top down, and they in some ways are expected to be these things. They expected Claire, the princess, to be a certain way that all princesses are, but they weren't right about that.
I'm torn on that, whether that's actually
I know, because
true.
You think it's an essentialist thing that they have.
Here's what I think. Yes, they are molded by adult expectations of them. Because if you come into class, right,
mm-hmm.
and you have a bender and a Brian.
Yes.
Which one do you think is going to be your better student?
Well, you would assume that Brian is. That's right. May not be correct.
That's right. But you will probably be correct because it's a self-fulfilling prophecy, right? You're going to give less time and attention to Bender. And in fact, you might actually be openly hostile to him. So, I mean, that's a real thing where adults impact how kids do in school or what their self-image is. But it also comes from the kids themselves. They're going to naturally kind of tribe up, you know, based on basically their personal image, their proclivities, their skills, etc. There's going to be some natural groups formed.
Yeah.
But it's artificial when it becomes, you know, isolated and you start assuming that everybody in that group is exactly the same, mm-hmm. right? That's where the stereotypes come in. But I do think that adults have a role in forming those images, the self-images that those kids have.
Mm-hmm. But that's what I'm saying is that in some ways it's top-down, in some ways it is probably essential,
yeah.
which is exactly what you're saying. And I agree 100% with that. But what's interesting then is the way they come to the realization when they come together and maybe these are not really real definitions or divisions. We are all of those things in our one body.
But that's a little idealized too, right?
It
that's
is.
Brian writing at the end where he's just, you know, bonded with all these guys and like, we're all a brain, a jock, a basket case, whatever. And to a certain extent, it's correct. But, you know, again, what happens on Monday?
You think she's going to change Bender. They're going to be a great couple, blah, blah, blah. That's really what you walk out thinking, you know, Allison, somehow those chasms will be overcome and everybody will be together and friends. And I really now, as an adult, I'm sorry, that's just not what happens.
Yeah.
As an adult, I can tell you for 100% sure they go back on Monday and they don't talk to one another. In the episode when we had Andrea on, we discussed where we thought some of them would be. So you've actually found now at the end of the movie, one of the scenes that was cut was what going to be a voiceover?
I guess, or maybe just interviewing, you know, where are they going to be in 30 years, mm-hmm. right? And Carl has his opinions.
Okay, so.
And they're a pretty dark opinion.
Okay, so say what Carl's opinions are.
This is in 30 years, mind you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so they're, you know, in their late 40s.
Do the first one, and then we'll talk about it.
Bender will have killed himself.
See, now that's wild, because you said Bender would have a hard time getting himself out of his cycle.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Well, I mean, that's just reality, right? People who go through that have a hard time breaking that cycle. Anxiety and depression and despair and violence and anger and all that stuff.
But what about that character would make... Now, this is to say that we, of course, recognize that people will take their own lives for all kinds of reasons, and
sure.
just because they're sad, they look outwardly okay, doesn't mean that the next day they could do something to harm themselves, because
right.
we don't know what everybody's experience is. So
right.
I recognize that that is a truth in the world, but I'm going to ask this question. What about Bender would in that character would have ever given even a hint of like he's going to hurt himself?
Well, I mean, he is seen violence as a means of problem solving for his whole life.
Yeah.
And you see how, you know, just torn up he is about how shitty his family is.
Right.
Right. How horrible his dad is.
Yeah.
How, you know, inactive his mom is to change anything, and how it's affected him. I mean, he's escaping through drugs and misbehaving. You know, now that's a stretch to say he goes from that to self-harm. It's not completely unimaginable, although you could make that argument for really any of the characters. The capacity to fall into that trap, that depression and see no escape, could have happened anyway. I mean, Brian actually thought about killing himself.
Exactly,
right?
Exactly.
Now, he wasn't very effective, but he did, you know, he had that thought.
Right. In my mind, Bender... Either he breaks the cycle, completely breaks
right.
the cycle, and he goes on and does whatever, or he doesn't, and you're correct about that.
Yeah.
My take on it wouldn't necessarily be that he would hurt himself, more that he would just repeat the hurting of others.
Right.
However, there is one thing about Bender that really took me aback, and I actually saw it again because I, as I was getting some clips for the other episode, I was watching when he's in the closet with Vernon, and Vernon is just like rattling on at him.
Yeah.
Bender's just kind of looking down, and then Vernon says, "I'll be there. Like, you're going to go when no one else remembers you and you're far away from this school. I will be there." And Bender starts like
not in a good way.
He looks at him and like he gets eye contact with him and he looks terrified.
Yeah.
And I just thought to myself, he is a really like the hurt that he is getting, the violence that he is getting at home.
Of course it's destroying
him. It's hurting him. Yeah. And he is hurt by that. And then he is hurt. He is seeing that outside even of his home, there's this.
This is what people are like.
People hurt. And I thought, oh my God. And it's such a brutal message.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think that I certainly didn't give it enough
weight
when I watched it as a young kid.
Oh, no, of course not.
You know, I just was,
just like, man, Vernon's a dick.
Yeah. And I understood Bender's anger. Yeah. I understood why he was angry and I cheered him on because really Bender is flying in the face of authority. No one as a teen, I mean, like what teenager doesn't like people who fly in the face of authority?
Sure.
In fact, Bender says to Claire as they're running through the hallway, you know, being bad feels kind of good.
Yeah, of course it does.
Yeah.
That's how you get the pretty girl is you be the bad boy.
I do hate that. I know that that's the trope and I hate that trope.
So the next one is Claire. Now, interestingly, he has a very shallow, appearance-oriented prediction for Claire. Nothing about her life.
Yeah.
Just about her appearance. Claire will have two boob jobs and a facelift.
Okay, see, now this is where this kind of thing was still acceptable.
Sure.
In the 80s, to talk about women that way. And I get the joke of that. I do. Right. I know that there's a funny thing in that, which is
she's obsessed with her appearance.
She's obsessed with her appearance, or that society forces her to be obsessed with her appearance. And, you know, I understand where that's meant to be funny. I don't, at this point, I don't find that funny. And it's not because I'm older, although I'm sure it is that, but it's more because I've just learned to understand better that that's just not okay. It's not okay to joke about that, about women that way.
Yeah. I mean, it's a cheap appearance-based joke.
Yeah.
All right. Brian will become very successful, but die of a heart attack due to the stress of a high-paying job.
He's
a little stress ball.
He is, but I think that Brian, no, I don't think so. Because Brian was able to share his emotions. Mm-mm. Either he'll be fine or he'll be the one that would hurt himself.
Yeah. But yeah, so that's his prediction for Brian.
Okay. What's the other one?
So for Allison, she will be a great poet. But nobody will care. Well, guess up. Welcome to poetry. Sadly, nobody cares. My son is a very good poet. Nobody cares but him and me. And maybe Carolyn, his wife. It's not a valued skill in the modern world.
I mean, I don't know that she necessarily would have cared if people didn't notice.
Yeah, she's got family money. She'll be fine.
Yeah, I think that she probably... I liked Andrea's version. You know, she actually realizes that she comes out as a lesbian or pansexual or whatever and ends up in Oregon driving a Subaru.
I don't think that that's mutually exclusive from what Carl's prediction is, though.
Could be, right? So
why
could
can't she be a lesbian poet that nobody cares
but
about?
But also a poet that, but I think that once she gets there and she finds herself or then she finds her friends. I think she finds her tribe. And I think that would be awesome. Still, she could be just a secretly great poet and not really doing poetry for a living.
Right.
But I think that she'll be happy and have a nice life and not be ignored. I don't think that she's destined to be ignored.
And then Andrew.
Yeah.
Which he gets a very superficial prediction as well, that he will marry a beautiful airline stewardess, but she'll get fat after a couple of kids. Okay, well, that's life, bro. I mean, that's how...
Oh, my God.
That's awful. I mean, first of all, nothing about who he is or what he becomes.
No.
Just that he married someone good-looking.
And then objectify her.
Yeah, and then implies that now he's unhappy because she's no longer svelte.
Yeah, but objectify her. It's all this battleground on, like, women's body right there.
Now, keep in mind, we can't really...
butt of two jokes.
We can't really get too upset about this because they were cut from the film.
No, right. No. I know.
So you have to give, you know, Hughes a little bit of credit. Not that we give him a lot of credit because he does have a lot of problematic stuff because, you know, for one thing, 80s.
Yeah.
I mean, in a movie about trying to see through stereotypes, there are a lot of stereotypes.
There really are. So what does that do to the message then? Which, because the message
it
is...
just complicates it. That's all. That's life.
Do you think that it's correct, the message?
That we shouldn't judge a book by its cover?
Mm-hmm.
Of course. Just because people have traits and characteristics and belong to a group or whatever, that's fine. What people get confused about is they think any kind of classification of a group is stereotyping. And that's not really what stereotyping is.
Mm-hmm.
What it is, because there are groups that may have certain characteristics in common, and mm-hmm. you can talk about those in an enlightened, intelligent way.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem is if when you take what you perceive to be the characteristics of the whole group and try to impose them on an individual,
mm-hmm.
that is stereotyping,
mm-hmm.
right? And that's where it's problematic, because just because somebody is a member of that group doesn't mean they're going to share all those characteristics or even any of them.
Right.
So that's why stereotyping is wrong, is because you're trying to be specific from a generalization.
Yeah, I agree with you. You know, I'm just thinking about the makeover scene with Molly Ringwald and Ally Sheedy. And it really does give this impression that she was better once she had this makeover.
Which is, you know, a very common teen movie trope. It's the awkward girl who, once she takes off her glasses and takes her hair out of a ponytail, oh my God, she's gorgeous underneath all of that, and now she's a better person, right? She's more appealing as a person. And that's just a dumb take on femininity in the 80s. Now, I assume that the argument is that Allison was hiding behind all of that costuming, right? She was hiding her true self behind that costuming,
mm-hmm.
because she was shy. And what better way to protect your shyness than to appear weird so people will leave you alone? So if they bring her into the light a little bit and mainstream her up, we might react against that, right? By saying, oh no, let her be, you know, just have her listen to The Cure instead of Duran Duran. What's the big deal, right? But
hey, I listen to both.
Yeah. But I mean, the metaphor is that she's removing the things that are keeping her, you know, keeping other people at arm's length. You know, it's still problematic because it does make her look like now she's an appealing person when she was a gross person before. But in the vocabulary of the time and in the vocabulary of those students, she was, right?
Mm-hmm.
She wasn't appealing. I like that black shit. Well, nobody else did, which is fine. But you do want to be appealing to other people at a certain point.
Maybe.
Well, that's how you form relationships.
Yeah, but I don't get the impression. So for me, I think that that's true of a lot of people, right? I think that a lot of people do feel that way. But I didn't get the impression from her that having all of those friends would matter. Right now, she doesn't have them. So you're saying she doesn't have them, but she secretly wants them?
Well, I mean, she was happy to befriend Andy. That worked out kind of good for her, at least for one day. You know, and when she said, I don't have any friends, she didn't say it in a celebratory manner.
Right.
She might want friends. I mean, it's human nature to want friends.
Maybe she just, she's just shut off. And then
like, if you have to choose for your children, do you want to have a child who's a complete loner or a child who has a group of friends?
Yeah.
That was her armor against having to deal with people and be in relationships with them. Not that she's not really weird. She is really weird, right? I mean, that's part of who
unusual.
She is.
Yeah. She's just unusual.
Yeah. She was also using that as a way to keep people away.
I'm gonna say, I kind of agree with you. If you think back to my the symbolic thing that I noticed, where they take as they're opening up to others, they're taking off layers of their clothing. And Andy does do that, but her transition is much slower.
Yeah.
She doesn't really...
She stays pretty covered.
I mean, she takes off her big parka, but pretty much she's got her big bag with her.
Right,
she's in the clothes that she's in. But at the very end is when she is finally out from behind all of that armor, as you called it. And maybe her armor was even more sturdy than everybody else's.
Right. Because, well, nobody tried harder to stay out of interpersonal relationships than she did.
That's right. And she really did.
Even Brian.
Yeah.
because demented and sad, but social. The other children, as he referred to them. So do you want a real dark one?
Yeah. Oh, yes.
All right. What is written on the wall right before the kids show up, written on the school wall? Do you remember that graffiti?
Oh, what was it? I just saw it again. What was it?
I don't like Mondays.
Yeah.
This refers to a school shooting.
No.
In 1979, committed by 16-year-old Brenda Spencer.
Oh, my God.
And again, I'm quoting from IMDb. Brenda's father gave her a rifle for Christmas in 1978. On January 29th, 1979, she used her new rifle to shoot 10 children and staff at Cleveland Elementary School in San Diego, California. The school was across the street from her house where she was during the incident. So she shot him long distance, I guess. She killed the school's principal and one of the custodians and injured 8 children. After 6 hours, she's apprehended by the police. When asked why she did it, she says, "I don't like Mondays. This livens up the day."
Oh, my God.
Pretty dark.
That's extremely dark and actually also sadly relevant.
Yeah.
Given what just happened over the last week in Texas. Horrifying.
Absolutely. And it also inspired, of course, the Boomtown Rats song, "I Don't Like Mondays."
Oh, wow.
That song is even darker than you thought. You thought it was just about, you know, losing the weekend.
No.
No, murder.
Oh, my gosh.
I know. That was fun, huh?
Oh, God. I'm like really, really depressed now.
Yeah. Snap out of it.
That's another one that's coming up. Okay. So let's talk about with the listeners about some of the, you know, give them a little sneak preview of some of the movies that we are going to be going through in this series. They're not going to be consecutive. So right. We always give our Patreon
A little glimpse into the future.
Yeah. So we have Moonstruck. So you said snap out of it. So Moonstruck is going to be one. When Harry Met Sally.
Oh, right. That's a pretty obvious one for you.
I really feel like we're going to have to get into The Godfather on this one.
Okay.
Because there are, I mean, it's a 1970s movie.
Well, I can tell you some of the lessons are things like put a little sugar in it. Oh, you roll the meatballs around in the pan.
Drop the cannoli. I can't even remember it. But there's lots of them.
Yeah.
I wanted to do Pretty in Pink.
Okay.
There are a bunch of others that Ghostbusters is one. We're going to do Ghostbusters.
I'm all about that.
Yeah. So we've got that coming up on our regular Gen Extemporaneous podcast.
I wonder if Back to the Future would be a good one.
That could be. I think that this is enough information. That was such a great movie. It was so much fun to rewatch it.
There's a lot of depth there. I mean, I think, and that speaks ultimately to the quality of the movie, is when you can have a conversation like this, because you can't have a conversation like this about, you know, Porky's, right?
No.
It's a little too one-dimensional, or even like something like Top Gun, right?
Yeah.
Which is just action-driven and whatever.
Could you have a conversation like that about The Hunt for Red October?
Perhaps, Vasily. Give me one ping only.
This is only because you want to do
I want to do a Scottish actor pretending to be a Russian by doing a Scottish accent.
All right.
He's a great actor. All right. So thank you, everybody, for being members of our Patreon.
Thank you very much. We appreciate you coming and listening to us each week.
Don't tell anybody what you've heard here. This is secret just for you guys. Don't forget to eat your Ovaltine.
And okay, well, have a great day. I don't know why I'm saying that. Okay, bye.
Peace out, Cub Scouts.
I said have a great day.